volunteered by Senior District Judge Marvin Garbus from the District of Maryland. He's a member of this panel on the cases being heard today. He also sat with a different panel yesterday. His appearance is a part of a program, as some of you may know, whereby district judges, including senior district judges, have been invited for some of our argument sessions during each quarter, each month. That program began in September and will continue indefinitely. So we appreciate your assistance, Judge Garbus. Welcome. We have on the list today a total of five cases, one of which is being submitted on the briefs without oral argument today, namely Appeal Number 06-3401, Phillips versus Merit System Protection Board. On the four-case argument list will appear argument first, then Appeal Number 06-7304, ALCO versus Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Sue, good morning to you. Welcome, and please proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Chief Judge Michel. May it please the court. What I'd like to do with the time allotted to me this morning is to just walk through the relevant statute and regulations and make some observations along the way. The statutory framework for the surviving spouse definition has been called a confusing tapestry by the Veterans Court. And what I'd like to hopefully show the court today is that there is an internally consistent interpretation of both the statute and the regulations that gets us to the result that we urge the court to rule on today.
So you're not attacking the statute or the regulation, but you're attacking an interpretation of the regulation?
Yes, Your Honor. We're attacking an interpretation of the statute and the regulation.
And the interpretation being found precisely where?
The interpretation in the Veterans Court's opinion, it would be found on page...
In this case?
In this case, it would be an interpretation of Section 101.
What I'm trying to understand is that there's no document, I take it, in which the secretary or other official of the department has stated an interpretation of the statute or regulation in question. It's just the opinion in this very case by the Veterans Court judge that you say constitutes such an interpretation.
Yes, Your Honor, but there is, of course, the interpretation of the agency as to the meaning of Section 101.3 in the pertinent regulations, which would be 3.50 and 3.53.
Do you agree that the statute is ambiguous?
Well, the statute doesn't define the key terms that we're concerned with today. The requirement of interest today in the statute is what's called the continuous cohabitation requirement. It's a requirement that a surviving spouse must have lived with the veteran from the date of marriage to the date of the veteran's death. And so there's an exception.
Yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
So your theory is the statute's ambiguous and under Chevron to look to the regulation.
Yes, Your Honor, but also to apply the plain meaning to the key words procured by and without fault of the spouse. In particular, procured by, the words procured by the veteran.
Can you, if the fault here, in terms of adjudication, was something said by the Veterans Court judge, can you direct us to the precise language that you regard as being the erroneous interpretation of the statute and or regulation?
Yes, Your Honor. In the Veterans Court's opinion, at page 4-5, the interpretation that we're complaining about is the statement, since the appellant has...
Where are you on page 4?
Your Honor, on the bottom of page 4, the second line from the bottom.
Thank you.
Since the appellant has explicitly conceded in her brief that the separation is by mutual consent without the fault of either party, she cannot prevail because the law and the regulation make an exception only for a separation caused by the veteran's misconduct. It is our position, Chief Judge Michel, that that's an erroneous interpretation of Section 1013, which clearly, as the words indicate, separate, it set out two different non-disqualifying separation scenarios. One is where the separation was due to the veteran's misconduct and without the fault of the spouse. The other scenario is where the separation was procured by the veteran and without the fault of the spouse. There are two non-disqualifying scenarios.
So then are you objecting to the word at the top of page 5 only? Saying that's an erroneous statement of the applicable law, the use of the word only?
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
Okay, now, is it possible that that is, error, and it may be certainly not very precise or comprehensive, but why would this be viewable as a harmless error or harmless inaccurate statement of the law?
Because, Your Honor, in the court below, the appellant urged the court to find that a separation by mutual consent without fault of the party qualified as a separation procured by the veteran without fault of the spouse under 1013 and under the interpreting regulation, which is 3.53B. And what the Veterans Court has apparently done here is to not look at 3.53B, but instead focus on 3.53A and which talks about the fact that, well, you know, a non-disqualifying separation is a two-part analysis. You have to, you can't just focus on the absence of fault of the spouse. You also have to focus on either the misconduct of the veteran or the fact that the separation was procured by the veteran. And so, in essence, what we're saying here, Your Honor, is that...
Well, he quotes from Gregory on page 4, the language at the end of that block quote near the bottom of page 4 of the opinion was due to the misconduct of or procured by the veteran. But you seem to be suggesting that because of the sentence ending at the top of page 5 and the use of the word only, that he was unaware of the two-part nature of the statute or the two-part nature of the regulation. But the language he quotes may suggest that he was perfectly aware of it and that the ensuing sentence that misstates the law was just a carelessly crafted sentence, but not proof that he thought it was a one-dimensional test.
Well, Your Honor, our reading of the Veterans Court's opinion is this. We argued that the court should focus on the separation by mutual consent, which we believe qualifies as a separation procured by the veteran without fault of the spouse. What the Veterans Court did in response was not to look at that, but rather to quote Gregory for the proposition that one cannot just focus on the absence of fault on the part of the spouse, but the opinion never addresses our argument, which is, well, what about a separation by mutual consent? Doesn't that qualify under the other part of the two-part test? I.e., doesn't that qualify as a separation procured by the veteran?
Because of the language of the regulation.
Yes, Your Honor. And also the plain meaning, I believe the Secretary in his brief has given the court some dictionary definitions of what it means to procure, to bring about, or cause to happen, which we would submit includes not just unilateral conduct by the veteran, but also situations where the veteran and his or her spouse agree that they should separate.
That's kind of a weak argument, isn't it? That the language of the statute is plain, your way, that seems to be kind of hard.
Well, I think that it's plain only so far as the dictionary goes, and that, of course, the court should take note of the agency's own interpretation of the statute in 3.53B.
You seek a remand or what? Well, if we were to be persuaded by you that there's sufficient reversible error here to justify a remand, we'd send it back to the Veterans Court, and then in your view, what should then happen?
Well, the Veterans Court should then rule on the issue that was argued below, which is whether a separation by mutual consent can fall within the purview of Section 1013 and Section 3.53b.
And I would assume, at least for purposes of argument, that if this went back to Judge Lance, for example, that in a similar non-precedential one-judge opinion, he would say no. And he would write a couple sentences explaining it, and then there'd be a new appeal, and we'd be back here again. If his opinion, as he wrote it, as we have it, implicitly rejects your principal argument, why can't we simply decide whether that argument is entitles your client to the relief sought, rather than having two more rounds of litigation, possibly just because of a carelessly written sentence in an opinion?
I suppose, Chief Judge Michel, that the court could do that here. As we've indicated in our briefs, we don't dispute the factual determinations by the board. The record is clear that
even if you did, we're not allowed to review them.
Right. So
it doesn't go anywhere for you to make that kind of argument.
That's correct, Your Honor.
If we look at the regulation clearly says, number one, that it can be, under the procured by label, a separation by mutual consent will fit if, and then it's the if, and then it's kind of very difficult to follow this. The parties lived apart for purposes of convenience, health, business, or any other reason which did not show an intent on the part of the surviving spouse to desert the veteran. I assume you're saying that in this case you fit in one of those other categories, and I guess we don't have the facts on the record to go into that, but if part of intent to desert, if that means intent to be separated from, which I guess it has to be, if you're talking about mutual consent, and then I would have to interpret the regs to say an intent of the surviving spouse not to intentionally live apart from the veteran. If that's the interpretation put on desert the veteran, then in this case when she says, well, we did it because we just couldn't get along, I'm not sure how you fit within the regulation.
Well, so to answer your question, Judge Garvis, we would interpret intent to desert to mean an intent to call the, you know, to say that the marriage is over, that there's no desire to stay together any longer. There clearly 3.53b covers a lot of scenarios where parties can live apart for reasons other than to say that the marriage is over.
Of course, you're not saying the marriage is over or else they get a divorce, but in this case, don't you have the woman having said we just couldn't get along, which is a statement that we don't intend to live together anymore?
Well, but there was an agreement by the parties to do that. I think intent to desert implies the fault element of the test, which is that there was an act of desertion or an intent to desert.
Well, why can't a consensual separation be viewed as a mutual desertion?
I suppose.
And therefore, under the statute and the reg, even though you can say, well, he was deserting her as much as she was deserting him, the part that counts under the reg is that she's deserting him. QED, she must lose and not get the money.
Well, I suppose it could, but clearly the agency didn't see it that way. The agency.
It would have been helpful, actually, if you bothered to look at dictionaries, because the dictionaries, including Black's Law Dictionary, define desert as being without the consent of the other spouse. And if you take that definition, desert, mutual separation, does not involve desertion by the spouse. spouse.
That would be true, Judge Dyke, yes. And in this case, there are many scenarios under which the parties can mutually agree to live apart for some reason. The law does not require that married couples always maintain their affections for one another or always find it that it's convenient to live together. So.
Aren't the examples listed in the reg all ones, at least the ones I can recall, that suggest that some external circumstance is more or less forcing the couple to live apart, to be separated, even though their loyalties or their emotional state would suggest that but for those external circumstances, they would continue living together. They want to continue to live together. They are getting along well, etc. Whereas here, it seems very clear to me, maybe I'm making it simpler than it is, but it seems very clear to me that these two people, by 1970, roundly disliked each other, didn't want to live together, didn't want to carry on an active marriage, and both couldn't wait to get the hell out of them. So it's hard to compare that characterization of the motivation of the couple with those examples in the regulation dealing with what I'm calling extraneous circumstances, which might force people to live apart, in effect, against their will. Here, living apart was in accordance with the will of each. Seems very different.
Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
Yes, indeed, you must.
Well, as the regulation says, it's a separation by mutual consent. So it means that the parties agree to live apart. And the examples, health, convenience, business, aren't limiting. There's the catch-all phrase. Any other reason, as long as it's a reason.
Doesn't the any other reason have to be any other reason of the same ilk as the examples listed above? Sort of a catch-all kind of thing, but still limited to the same type of reason.
I would say no, Your Honor. It just has to be any other reason that doesn't show an intent on the part of the surviving spouse to desert this unilateral act, as Judge Dyke mentioned.
All right.
Thank you.
Sir, we'll give you 2 minutes back of rebuttal, even though time has expired. We'll hear from the government. Ms. Burke, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Welcome. Please proceed.
May it please the Court. The Veterans Court judgment should be affirmed. According to Ms. Alpo's view, any separated couple.
What we have here is we have this for any other reason, which does not show intent on the part of surviving the spouse to desert the veteran. Now look at Black's Law Dictionary. It says in family law, the five elements of spousal desertion are, and list the five, one of those is lack of consent. Why shouldn't we read this regulation as adopting the standard desertion definition in family law from the Black's Law Dictionary, which requires a lack of consent? And if that's correct, isn't the veteran right about the construction of the regulation?
Let me just make sure I understand your question. If desertion includes lack of consent, then, well, in this situation.
Doesn't the veteran win? Widow. I mean, the veteran's widow.
Well, no, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because there was consent.
No. That is the point. The definition. It's not desertion. It's consensual. That's what the dictionary says. It is not desertion. It's consensual. So we have to ask whether there was desertion. No desertion. It's consensual. If there's no desertion, then mutual consent separation is okay.
And I understand, I apologize. First of all, it's helpful, and I apologize that we didn't do this in our brief, but it was unclear to us exactly what provision Ms. Alpo was relying on until the reply brief, in which she really focuses on 3.53b. But if you go back and you look at board decisions, which either post-date or predate, this regulation, and there weren't really board decisions that predated the statute, but to the extent that there were pension decisions, it becomes clear that what desertion means is an intent to leave. And so the context that it normally comes
from. Are you suggesting that in adopting the regulation that the Veterans Administration adopted the rationale of the board decisions as opposed to the general definition of family?
Well, I guess I would have to look at the definition of the Black's Dictionary and figure out, you know, what date it, for example, was issued to try and figure out whether the concept of desertion is a more modern one. Because I think one of the
this goes back edition after edition. That doesn't help.
Well, one of the difficulties that I think we have in this case is the terminology for separations and divorces changes over time. So, for example, you have the concept of fault, both in the statute and in the regulation. That is not the concept of fault that has developed since then.
We're not talking about fault here. We're talking about the operative legal word, desertion. And if you're going to say that the Secretary's regulation necessarily embodied a special, unconventional definition of desertion, then for at least one judge, you're going to have to show me some regulatory history or some definition in the reg itself that shows such a clear intent.
Could I venture into this,
Judge?
Sure. If you have a regulation that has the separation has to be by mutual consent and has to have no intention to desert, then if desert is giving the normal meaning that Judge proposes, perhaps the regulation has no meaning at all. Because if mutual consent necessarily excludes desertion, you don't need categories. And then it would be logical to say that in this context, using the word to desert has to mean something other than an absence of mutual consent, because if there's no mutual consent, you're not there in the first place. I don't know if that was clear enough, but I can understand that in this context, that there can be two kinds of separations by mutual consent. One is we consent, but we really want to get back together if we can. And, or at least the surviving spouse says, I want to get back together if we can. And another is we separate by mutual consent, the surviving spouse doesn't have any intention to get back together, even though both of those have mutual consent. I'm just wondering if that's an angle.
Well, I think I understand your question. I feel what you're saying, and I think I might agree, that the phrase, for any other reason that does not show intent to desert, I don't think I'd call it meaningless, but it might not be necessary to understand the previous part of the regulation, which clearly says that if the separation was by mutual consent and the parties lived together for some other reason that had nothing to do with their incompatibility. I think that the add-on or any other reason that does not show an intent to desert is really just meant to define all of those other categories. Those categories are obviously not categories that would exist if one of the parties intended to leave the other party.
Well, what is desert?
I don't have the Black's Dictionary definition in front of me, and apparently it has five provisions. But what desert means with respect, or in the way that the board has interpreted it in these kinds of cases, means an intention to leave the other party. So, for example, in a situation where the parties are separated.
What cases are those?
I'm sorry?
What cases are those?
I'm talking about board cases, which, if you look at them online, are don't have any names for confidentiality.
It's not in your brief. You're depending on board opinions that are not provided in the appellate record in this case?
Well, I'm talking about the interpretation of the Board of Veterans Appeals, which...
We don't defer to that.
You do defer to that, absolutely.
Defer to that in the interpretation of the regulation.
To the board's, to the agency's interpretation of its own regulation, absolutely.
Are they interpreting the regulation?
Every time they're applying this regulation to a particular set of facts.
No, but have they interpreted the regulation? Have they said that the meaning of the word desert in the regulation is different from the normal meaning, and this is why we think it means this. Have they undertaken an analysis of the regulation?
No, not in that particular way, but they have consistently found that, and the District of Columbia Circuit has also addressed the issue in a case called Carter. They've consistently found that deserting somebody merely shows an intent to leave. So, for example, if a wife is separated from her husband and not yet divorced and has a baby with another man, that is evidence of desertion. That is no longer the case. These are very, very old cases. But that is a particular example of a situation that would evidence desertion.
Those aren't cited in your brief.
No, Your Honor, but they're not really citable. I can certainly give you the website, but I can't give you the name of a particular case because the names are confidential. These are board decisions.
Board decisions.
Unpublished board decisions.
Well, they're published without the identifying information.
But are they considered to be precedential by the board?
I don't know the answer to that. I would assume so, but I don't know the answer to that.
But you're asking us to say every time the board has applied this regulation, even without any linguistic analysis in their opinion, they have done a construction of the words in the regulation, and therefore it's an interpretation of the regulation embedded in an application of the regulation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And this court in Smith found that to be perfectly appropriate and warranting deference.
Well, I'm challenging the premise. It seems to me that applying a statute or a reg to a particular set of established facts is different from interpreting the meaning of words and phrases in that statute or regulation. And therefore, if a board decision comes out with a result based on the facts through applying the statute, but never interprets the meaning of some word or phrase in the statute, then I don't agree with you that there's an interpretation. There's only an application. And therefore, the board decision is worthless for the purpose you're citing.
So your question, I believe, is that if there's no actual explicit discussion, we are interpreting this particular regulation and here's our interpretation, that there is no interpretation, I think I would disagree with that.
Well, I understand you disagree with that, but what's your authority for saying that the application of the statute always involves, even if there's no discussion, an interpretation of the words and phrases in the statute?
Well, we don't even have to go so far as to look at other board decisions. We can look at the board decision in this case, which, according to Smith, is enough of a pronouncement, or the briefs by the parties is enough of a pronouncement about the agency's interpretation of the regulation.
Yeah, well, brief. Smith says explicitly that the litigating position doesn't count.
I believe it says the opposite. It
says the litigating position.
And we're only talking about an interpretation of the agency's interpretation of a regulation, obviously not a statute, but yes.
Where did the board in this case interpret the regulation?
Well, first of all, we can start with on page 27 of the joint appendix, in the middle paragraph, the paragraph that begins with VA does not dispute. This is not an indirect answer to your question, but I just want to point out that the board specifically addressed the question of misconduct and whether misconduct had been alleged, and noted that it hadn't been alleged, and this gets back to...
But address my question. Where did they tell us what the meaning of desertion was?
Well, Your Honor, there's no specific discussion of the desertion question in this particular board decision because it wasn't raised to the board.
No, but I thought you said that we could look at this board decision to find out how the board interpreted the regulation.
Well,
I seem to be saying that they didn't interpret.
What I meant was we can look to this particular board decision to see the interpretation of the regulations that were raised before it.
So this board decision didn't interpret desertion?
No, but that's because it wasn't raised before it, which brings up an additional issue of why this question, or how this question can possibly be raised now when the board never addressed it. Because at the time that this issue was before the board, the question was whether the separation was a result of an illness. And Ms. Alpo seems to be conceding that that is no longer the case. But that is the decision that the Veterans Court was reviewing, and that is the decision that the board was making.
Is there any other board decision that specifically interprets desertion? Are you aware of?
In the way that Judge Michelle was suggesting, not that I'm aware of, in an explicit way.
And even if there were, what's the authority of saying that Chevron deference attaches to an individual board decision?
Well, I think it would be a little bit more than Chevron deference. I think that when the agency is interpreting its own regulation, at least according to Smith,
What I'm trying to get you to focus on is this distinction. If the secretary issues some proclamation that says, last year I issued regulation 101, in it are the following six words. I construe those six words to mean, and then he goes on and sets it forth in this proclamation. That would certainly be a case in which the agency, acting through the secretary, is interpreting its own regulations issued a year earlier. So if there had been some proclamation like that, that would make a big impression, at least on me. But I'm not familiar with the idea that any time the board issues a result, that's the agency interpreting its own regulations in a way that would bind the courts. It would seem to me that would not be an agency interpretation.
I'm not suggesting that the mere application of a set of facts to the regulation equals the agency's authoritative interpretation of its own regulation. What I'm suggesting is that if all of the board decisions apply this regulation in exactly the same way, then the meaning of the regulation becomes clear. That language, or any other reason that does not show an intent to desert, really just modifies the previous part of the sentence, meaning that the only way that a separation by mutual consent can get around the continuous cohabitation rule is if there's some reason that doesn't have anything to do with the parties wanting to leave each other as a matter of their relationship.
Even if the board had interpreted this regulation the way you wanted to interpret it, which apparently they haven't done, well, wouldn't you still have a problem in the sense that the regulation seems to be clear on its face? As the word desert has a well-accepted meaning, it's not an ambiguous term.
Well, I'm obviously a little bit of a disadvantage because I don't have that definition in front of me, but the way that Your Honor read the definition suggests to me that there are five requirements, and if one of them, and this is assuming that we agree, that if one of them doesn't quite fit with the situation, and if it's a disjunctive set of requirements, then obviously there's no problem.
I don't think they're disjunctive. I think there's what Blacks is suggesting, that desertion requires all five of these things. I don't think that works.
Well, perhaps it would be more helpful, and I'm out of time, but if I could just make one last comment, perhaps it would be more helpful.
You'll be out of time, and we're out of questions.
Yeah, if the court focuses on the expression intent to desert, obviously the question whether there has been a desertion is not an issue in this regulation. The question is whether there's a reason that shows intent to desert. And
I don't understand what you're saying.
If the definition of desertion gives five requirements, and if you don't fulfill all of those requirements, then you haven't deserted someone, then perhaps it would be more helpful to focus on the language of the regulation, which only requires that you show, that you do not show an intent to desert. You don't have to
show that you deserted. Whether you've deserted or only harbored an intent to desert doesn't get around the problem. You still have to know what constitutes desertion. If I'm going to attempt to desert somebody, we'll never be able to answer the question of whether I had such an intent unless we know what it was. Intent to murder, intent to rob, intent to rape, intent to steal. You can't tell whether the intent is there unless you know what the act is that you're talking about.
Are you saying, counsel, that if her feeling was, even if he wants me to come back to live with him, I don't intend to go back with him, that would be an intent to desert?
Yes, and we certainly have that in the record on page 84 of the joint appendix. We have Madalco saying, I don't think we're getting back together, or something to that effect, which seems on its face to be a clear intent to desert her husband. And I'm not really sure how that can be undermined by the Black's Law definition of desertion. Because if you say that you would effectively say that you intend to desert someone, I'm not sure whether you have to fulfill all of the five requirements that would actually constitute a desertion. But I think it's more helpful to read the regulation as a whole, and it says that if there's mutual consent and you have one of these kinds of convenient situations, and you don't really want to leave your partner, then you are considered to be still continuously cohabiting.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sood. You have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice Schell. Just like to address the court on this dialogue regarding the provision, health, convenience, business, and any other reason not showing an intent on the part of a spouse to desert. It's our position that the regulation sets out a broad category of reasons, which are any reasons not showing an intent to desert, and that health, convenience, and business are but examples within that larger set. And the key point, as Judge Dyke said, is that there can't be a situation where the spouse is saying, I'm going to leave you, and the veteran says, no, please don't do that. You know, there's got to be some mutual agreement, and it may be for external reasons, it may be for circumstances not under the control of either party, or it could be for a reason, internal, private to the parties. And in Stilwell versus Brown, the Veterans Court said that Section 3.53B was intended to be used as a shield by the spouse, not as a sword against the spouse. And we would submit that that's the kind of interpretation that one must give to Section 3.53B. It's meant to be liberal. It's meant to be remedial. It's meant to allow the spouse to show that in cases where there's mutual consent for the separation, that there are good reasons why the parties would have lived apart.
Well, I understand your position at bottom to be that it doesn't matter whether they had any reason, much less a good reason. As long as they both consent, then the survivor will get the money. Isn't that your core position?
Except that in the fact-finding that goes on within the agency, that the agency must elicit some sort of reason from the spouse as to why the separation occurred. And the regulation says that the statements of the spouse will be deemed controlling absent contradictory evidence.
So I guess you would admit that in a situation in which the spouse says, I can't stand it anymore, I'm leaving whether you agree or not,
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, we thank both counsel. We'll take the appeal under advisement.